ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. In August last year, I had a wild conversation with two fabulous podcasters and deeply serious women from Washington, D.C. Hannah Rosen of The Atlantic magazine and her collaborator and partner, Lauren Ober, who were then on tour in Australia. Donald Trump had just sent troops into the streets of Washington. We ranged widely from Trump's war on Democratic cities to the MAGA backlash against Me Too to scented candles that smell like freedom. You loved them then, so here they are again. Hannah Rosen and Lauren Ober host the podcast We Live Here Now, a deep dive into the MAGA world that has penetrated Washington, not just the capital, but now, as they discovered, its prosperous suburbs. Some years ago, Hannah wrote an extraordinarily prescient book about the deep shifts in American society. The book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Now, she says, we are living through the backlash. These days, she is host of The Atlantic magazine's podcast Radio Atlantic, and hosts podcasts with her partner, Lauren, a celebrated podcaster in America. And Hannah and Lauren are with me in the studio now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Now, you live in Washington. Hannah, does it need, as Trump says, saving from complete and total lawlessness?
Is that a serious question?
It's a serious quote.
No, I realize that. I mean, that's the same way that Los Angeles needed saving from marauding crowds, which did not show up on camera. No, we have our problems, like every city has its problems. But the last thing we need is the federal government to override our local police and our local decision making with their own plan.
Is this just a diversion by Trump to make the media look at something else other than Epstein and his failure to stop wars?
It's always difficult to tell intentionality with Trump. I don't really know if this is an organized game plan, which is trying to get you to look over here. It might just be that he woke up and said, oh, it's time for me to do a 1980s cities are out of control move like he's done with other cities. So he might have just, you know, one of his people got carjacked. Somebody who worked in Doge with Elon Musk got carjacked. And so
known as Big Balls.
Known as Big Balls, exactly. I mean, this story couldn't write itself. Big Balls was carjacked. There was a picture of Big Balls bleeding on the ground. We don't know where the blood came
from.
Allegedly. And so then, you know, and then there was marauding teens of the kind that we talked about in the 1980s in the wilding years when Trump used to say the same thing about New York City. DC has certain crime problems. It's a city, of course.
Right. Lauren, this has to be reported, of course. But how do you report these stunts of Trump's?
I'm not sure how anybody reports it seriously. But I think that, I don't know, we live in a sort of fact light era now. And so, you know, reporters in the U.S. have said D.C. doesn't have a crime problem. In fact, it's a 30-year low in crime. And we live there. And while there is crime, just like Hannah said, in any other city, we're not, you know, we're not dodging bullets left and right. So I guess the best that you can do is say, this is actually the picture on the ground and show people, you know, what reality is. But what does reality even matter anymore?
Also, the way Trump lumps things together, like homelessness and crime, those are two very different problems that require two different, very different approaches and solutions.
But You talked, Lauren, about fact light. I wonder whether in the past we overestimated the power of fact to convince. We are now in an era where the most hilarious lies convince people. Immigrants are eating pets. Children have got sandboxes so they can piss because they believe they're furries. Absolute nonsense. But maybe lies were always believed and we didn't realize.
Well, sure. I mean, think about, I like to go back to couples therapy for lots of lots of my answers, but feelings and facts are different. And facts, when you are in an argument with your partner, often are not the thing that move the other one, right? And so, I mean, maybe that's where we are, that we got into a problem earlier in the Biden administration with the economy, and the economy, numbers-wise, looked great. But people didn't feel like it was great. And so you get into a problem where their feeling does not match the fact. And so you could tell all the facts you want, and if people aren't feeling it, it doesn't matter.
I want to say one other thing, which is the outrageousness of the lies is part of the point. This is my great revelation of living under Trump.
That they're kind of thrilling.
It's more that I've now had an unwilling education in how autocracies work. This is an education I never asked for and didn't want. But one of the things that happens is that the autocrat presents you with a lie that's obviously a lie in order to test your loyalty. If you come along with me and believe this lie with me, then you have shown me that you are loyal. And so the point is to present you with something that could not possibly be true, and then look around the room and see who repeats it. That person is your ally. That's how this whole system works. So we all knew they weren't eating the pets, and we knew they weren't pissing in the sandboxes. But if you just said the obvious things, which is like, they're not eating the pets, then you're not on my team. So it's part of how the system works.
And loyalty is the key.
Loyalty is the key. It doesn't, the truth is completely irrelevant. It's beside the point. In fact, they're testing you.
Lauren, do we underestimate the power of shamelessness? This is a man without shame, and that is a powerful position to be, isn't it?
I mean, I feel like America is a shameless country, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know if is he shameless, or is something else going on? It's hard to tell. I'm not sure. Do you have a thought on that?
I mean, I'm going to confess. You know, 20 some years ago, when I was starting out in journalism, I used to have this fantasy of doing a project of I'm going to be an asshole every day, sort of like Larry David's show, you know? And I was like, what would happen if you walked around in the world just being an asshole?
Deliberately being an asshole.
Like, how would the world change in response to you? What could you get away with? Now I feel like that's the experiment we're living under. It's like, I'm just going to wake up in the morning and do whatever, you know? Well, so
right. But also, everything is more and more extreme online. In order to get anyone's attention, the messaging has to be extreme. So you can't just say, hey, I think that carjacking has gone up a little bit in DC. You actually have to say that it's totally lawless and there are marauding crowds and everyone's getting raped. And it's like, wait, what? Like, one guy got carjacked.
Right, exactly.
Yep. Let's go back to an era when books counted a great deal.
Didn't you just write one, David?
Well, of course, and it's transformed Australia, Hannah, as people will tell you.
We've heard, actually, in America.
About the book.
Yeah.
My book, Transforming Australia.
It's actually transforming Australia. America as we speak.
Really? Race relations in the South? Yes. I have high ambitions for it. Shut up. Hannah, you wrote The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and I wonder when you wrote that, whether you were hoping for a reasonable outcome from this deep shift in the roles of men and women in society.
I ended that book saying there are two options here. You know, I'm witnessing a revolution between men and women, particularly in certain classes. It's happening, everyone. It could end up in one of two ways. One, is that we soften around what traditional gender roles are. So men start to become, say, nurses in the U.S., which is because that's a profession that's growing, or they don't mind so much if their wives make more money than they do. That was one direction. The other direction was all hell breaks loose. Like, they just remain stuck around it, and they can't take it, and there's just a massive backlash. That's what I threw out there when I would give my talks. We all know which direction it went, which is B, number two, the second one.
So, why did it have to go in that direction, do you think?
You know, I think about that so much. Why did it have to go in that direction? Why isn't there a little bit of flexibility here? In fact, the unusual thing that happened is there has been a ton of gender bending in the last 10 or 12 years in certain sectors. Like, there's a lot more talk, I don't know about here, but in the US, a lot more younger kids who are queer and talk about it, or who are trans and talk about it. So that is one direction, but that's been followed by an equally strong backlash that's gone fairly mainstream. I can't answer why. I don't know. You tell me why. We're just women.
We're just women. Yes. We don't know.
We don't know anything.
Well, you're very lucky to have me here, because I can guide you in all kinds of ways.
Yes.
But nevertheless, Lauren, I am curious about your views. Why did it have to be this way? Was it because ruthless political operators understood that there was resentment there that could be manipulated for enormous political power?
Well, I don't need to chime in on that. I think you just summed it right up there. Yeah, it is. It does feel like a manipulation. Like, see, you men were so much happier, and everything was so much better back in the good old days, you know, back when men were men. And it feels depressing to be marching backwards. I mean, our Secretary of Defense retweeted a post about how women shouldn't vote. Like, how retrograde can you get?
I mean, sometimes...
Oh, but Lauren, that was for Christian reasons. For heaven's sake, be fair.
I'm so sorry.
There was to be a Christian sort of confab in the family, and a Christian decision would be made about who to vote for.
Right.
And then the man would do it.
Right. Well,
obviously
all families are all Christian, and all families are all one man and one woman. So yes, no, obviously that's the way it should work.
And they all have only one politics.
Yes.
Right. Well, the women actually don't have really the opinions. They say, yes, honey, that's a great idea. I agree with you. Would you like some more meat?
But
I watched you, Lauren, look at Hannah as you said that, and it seemed to me that you were saying something very familiar to her, something that you've said before. Look, honey, you know, I'll take your view on this.
Yep, look, honey, you're a vegetarian. So.
That is often how it works in our relationship, where I just submit.
Shut up. Wait.
I'm calling this to order. I know it's my fault, but I am calling it to order. I'm speaking to Hannah Rosen, who is host of the podcast Radio Atlantic and co-host with her partner, Lauren Ober, also with me here on the podcast We Live Here Now, which we are now going to talk about.
Wonderful.
Good. Now, Hannah, was it you who made the discovery that you had a very interesting woman living down the street?
It wasn't me who made the discovery. It was a group discovery. We put our friends are journalists and real estate agents, and we put little clues together and discovered it one day after an incident. We had an incident in which Lauren, who has a mouth, yelled at a woman in a car, and that woman yelled back at her, and we thought, that was a really unusual exchange. And after that incident, we got together and sleuthed
Lauren
in the living room.
Can you give us a picture of this exchange, what provoked it, and what words were exchanged?
Sure. So we live in Washington, D.C., in the actual city, in the capital city. We were walking our dogs close to our house.
Whenever dogs are mentioned on this show, we need to know what brand of dog they are and what their names are.
Well, they're not a brand because we didn't buy them in the store. They are mutts off the street.
Yep.
One is Davey and one is Brian.
Davey. Yes, Lauren, go on.
So we were walking our dogs and we were walking past a white house. And outside the White House, there was a vehicle that had a number of stickers on it. And the stickers indicated a militia. There are a handful of militias in the United States. This was called the Three Percenters, and we had seen it in the neighborhood before. And when we walked past it, I happened to say, there's that militia mobile again, but I said it a little more blue than that.
You can say it blue on the shore.
There's that fucking militia mobile again. Yeah. And I was just saying it as an aside to Hannah, but it turns out there was someone sitting in the car. And they heard that, and they rolled down their window, and they said, "Justice for January 6th," they shouted. And I immediately, reflexively, because I don't have much of a filter, said, "Well, you're in the wrong neighborhood for that, honey." And she said, "We live here now, so suck it, bitch." And then we just kept on walking the dogs. And we thought, well, that was a mighty odd exchange for our particular neighborhood. And that's when we started.
You wanted to know who this woman is.
Absolutely.
And who did she turn out to be?
Well, she turned out to be the mother of Ashley Babbitt, who was the only person shot and killed on January 6th, the January 6th riots on our Capitol in the U.S.
Hannah, remind us who Ashley Babbitt was and the circumstances in which she was shot.
Ashley Babbitt was one of what we now call insurrectionists. She came with a lot of friends over to Washington. There were tens of thousands of people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th in response to Donald Trump's call, although just, that is contested.
This is to prove that Washington is a lawless place, was it?
This is to prove that Donald Trump actually did win the election and that the election was stolen.
Of course. Yes. Of course. So they are storming the Capitol.
They are storming the Capitol to show that, no, this new president cannot take his seat in this Capitol because that seat does not belong to him. So in their minds, they're preventing a great wrong from taking place in the history of American democracy, which is the wrong man taking the seat.
Yep.
That's what they think they're doing. And Ashley Babbitt was one of those people. She's actually a veteran. She was quite young. She came from California. She stormed the Capitol with some friends. She tried to break through a window inside the Capitol, through which you could see congressmen being evacuated. They were at that very moment voting to confirm the election. And so she tried to launch herself through a window pane and was shot by a Capitol police officer.
It's a bit rough, actually, to shoot somebody for coming through a window, isn't it?
Well, there were hundreds of people lined up behind her. And with any manner of, I mean, nobody knew what weapons there might be. People had stanchions and sticks and broken glass. I mean, there
were
hockey sticks. People brought all kinds of makeshift weapons. And so there was one police officer who was manning the door, and he was the only thing standing between this mob of rioters and the congresspeople behind him. And he was, according to the Capitol Police, within his rights, within his purview to protect the congresspeople behind him. And he chose to do that by shooting this person who he deemed a threat.
He did announce himself, by the way. There are many, many videos of this incident from lots of angles. It's not clear whether she heard him, but it is clear that he said, "I have a gun," and he pointed his gun for a while.
Let's hear what Donald Trump has to say about Ashley Babbitt.
"It is my great honor to address each of you gathered today to cherish the memory of Ashley Babbitt, a truly incredible person. Together we grieve her terrible loss. There was no reason Ashley should have lost her life that day. We must all demand justice for Ashley and her family."
But you two set out to talk to her family, to talk to the mother, whose name is Mickey Witthoff, to tell this story. Now, what did you discover, Lauren, along the way about Ashley, about the MAGA movement, about Mickey Witthoff?
A lot. I mean, I think both got a full education in a part of the political landscape that we, you know, we knew from our work as journalists, but didn't really know intimately. And I think that we intimately became acquainted with people, not only Mickey Whithoff, but also her roommate, whose husband was one of the first people who was arrested and put in jail. And they both became they both became leaders in this movement to free all of these people who were arrested and convicted and put in prison for their involvement in January 6th. And it was really interesting trying to find some, I don't even know if we tried to find common ground, but when you're approaching people as neighbors, right, you're making an effort to understand them, which I think that we did. We made an effort to understand, where are you coming from? What is this pain? It is a terrible thing to lose a child. And it provokes all kinds of responses in people who have endured that. And I think that we learned a lot about this country, about this political movement. It was like a trial by fire, I think.
Hannah, what did you learn from this woman that you hadn't grasped before?
Well, she was apolitical before her daughter got killed. So I think the process of getting to know her was somewhat the process of understanding how Americans get sucked into a world like this, how they come to believe a worldview which is somewhat conspiratorial. They come to believe that all the government is against them, except maybe this one man who's not against them and has some of the answers. I came to understand how, you know, she's a working class person, how she came to believe that Republicans were on her side and going to do this thing for her. So it's essentially what happened to her is what's happened to our entire country. So understanding that at an intimate level is important. You know, it's easy to be on our side and think like, what the hell does anyone see in this guy? So I think if you follow closely somebody's political evolution, you see how bit by bit by bit you come to rely on this person as the person who might get you out of this bind that you're in.
Right. And can I add to that? Her feeling, Mickey Whithoff's feeling was, if they could do this to my daughter, what couldn't they do? So if nobody was punished after somebody killed my daughter and the person who killed my daughter was not punished and it was in her mind swept under the carpet, what terrible things can't they do? And I think that her daughter had already gone down the QAnon MAGA rabbit hole online. I mean, she fully believed that, you know, that Democrats were drinking babies' blood, you know, in order to get strong or something. Mickey was not there. But after her daughter was killed, her mind became open to, you know, many possibilities. You know, she believed sort of every conspiracy or thought every conspiracy could conceivably be true.
But it's a uniquely terrible way to get sucked into this world, isn't it? To lose a daughter to an act of violence like this. So, you know, is she a typical MAGA supporter or is she somebody whose arrival there is kind of almost unique?
She's not typical, but I think the fact that she lost a daughter was what allowed us, from a storytelling perspective, to have the audience be sympathetic and bond with her. You know, if we'd just taken a typical MAGA person on the street, how did they become a conspiracy theorist? Instead, you're taking someone whose child was killed, and I think everybody can understand that and go along with it. So it allows you to sort of enter her brain a little bit.
But also I will say that there were aspects of her that were typical MAGA, which is that she grew up working class, she always struggled, and she felt somewhat oppressed by liberal ideology around race, around the economy. You know, she would
white privilege.
She was very upset about this idea because she said, well, I don't have anything, so what white privilege do I have? And we got into many conversations, and I would explain to her, you know, I said, look, you could go into a grocery store right now, shoplift your entire cart, and nobody would look at you because you're a white woman. And she would push against that. I mean, we had a lot of very vigorous debates about things like that. And she said, you know, look, I've never been able to get ahead in this country. And she lived in an area of California, San Diego, which is right on the border with Mexico. And she said, you know, there are these people streaming in. They feel like invaders to our country and they are getting stuff and I'm not. So she's not that different than a sort of typical MAGA voter, except that she was just apolitical. She wasn't out there on the street. She didn't campaign for anybody. She was just sort of casually a supporter.
You spend time with these people. And I have a detail here in my notes that I really need explaining. Candles that smell like freedom. How does a candle smell like
freedom? Wow, you really went in the archives for that one.
Can I bow down? That is some Lauren Ober poetry. Candles that smell like freedom.
So there is a conference that is held every year. It's the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, they call it. And, you know, look, there is a huge grift element to, or maybe I shouldn't say grift element to MAGA. There is a huge money-making aspect to it. So you
just because Donald Trump sold Bibles with his name on the cover, you're bringing this up now in Australia. But please, Lauren, I mustn't interrupt.
Don't
please
you feel go like on. If an Australian or a foreigner, like if they were to make up a parody of what an American merch convention looks like,
right? Like a political convention and the merch therein, it would be like golden sneakers, a Bible with an embossed Trump, you know, logo across it.
T-shirts with the picture crypto. Of Trump and a AK-47. Right. And yet they wouldn't be making
God's guns and Trump. But it is.
But here in Australia, and I can tell you where to go, you can go to a pet shop. You may need two of these because you have two dogs, but you can go to a pet shop and you can get a little Trump toy for dogs. You know how dogs
like to rip it apart.
Well, no, you don't rip it apart. They go honk, honk on it. And they're very satisfying. I can give you the address, but sorry, I'm interrupting you.
No, I mean, that would fit in perfectly at this convention, which I mean, it sold, you know, every kind of miracle cure for things.
So you live forever?
Yeah, colloidal silver and a platform that you stand on that shakes all your fat away. And all of this stuff was somehow part of, now it seems mainstream MAHA, Make America Healthy Again.
Something that takes your vaccines away. It sucks them out of you. Yeah,
but it does feel, you know, I was wandering around this place with Mickey Witthoff and the other people who were living in her house, and I just could not believe that anyone took it seriously because it all felt it felt like a joke.
But can I just say, even though the merch felt like a joke, Trump would unveil at these kinds of very closed-in events where he knew these were his, you know, super supporters, some of the darkest, most apocalyptic messages of his entire campaign, like the kinds of messages that were very, you know, a storm is coming, like this country is going to rot, and the only person who can save you is me. I mean, some of the most extreme autocratic rhetoric, which now we kind of laugh about or we, you know, we're used to. But in these kinds of conventions, that is where that kind of thing would have been.
I know my listeners will want me to draw you back to the question.
Sorry.
The candles.
Which was?
The candles.
The candles. Well,
did you smell?
He wants to know precisely what goes in.
So the smell of freedom is gunpowder, sweat, pine trees.
And German Shepherd.
I don't know. What you mean, wet dog? I'm not sure, but I'm thinking it's the smell of like some kind of like
non-masculinity,
right? Gasoline.
Gasoline.
So it's right. It's gunpowder, gasoline. What else did I say?
Sounds a bit more like a soap than a candle. It could be both.
Well, listen, I wouldn't knock it until I tried it. So.
And did you try it?
Well, no. Now, I didn't want to get too close because I didn't want anyone to think that I was there for fun. I wanted it to be very clear.
You laughed afterwards.
That I was working. Well, it you can laugh and then feel that, you know, to be quite honest, I felt sad because I felt that people were being sold all kinds of trash, not just in a material physical form, but also in the rhetoric and in the terrifying rhetoric. And CPAC actually got way worse after we left, because that's where Elon Musk showed up the next year with his, you know, chainsaw of liberty or whatever it was that he was going to chainsaw away, you know, all of the grift and graft.
Well, that
of the
went well.
American government. Yeah, it really did.
But also he unveiled at that meeting, or it was one of the first places that Trump unveiled the January 6th song. The song that
the prison choir.
And that's when we first got the hint that he might release, that he was starting to see the January 6ers as freedom fighters, because he melded his own campaign song with the January 6th. What was the song that they sang? It wasn't the Star Spangled
Banner. No, they gave, it was the Pledge of Allegiance. It was Donald Trump.
Donald Trump was saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
The Pledge of Allegiance. It was Donald Trump saying the Pledge of Allegiance, and it was the January 6th prison choir singing the national anthem.
Right.
Fantastic. On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. And you're listening once again to Hannah Rosin and Lauren Ober in one of the conversations I most enjoyed in 2025. So what did Mickey Whithoff think of it in the end?
Well, she told me she wasn't going to listen to it. And then she listened to every single episode. And she told me she thought it was fair. And we didn't pull any punches. We did not sugarcoat it. It was rough in some spots, but she felt like it was fair because we spent time and she got to say what she needed to say. And I feel like in a situation like that where you are diametrically opposite politically, you know, that's the best that you can hope for, is that it was fair.
And it's still up there, isn't it? We can listen to it.
You absolutely can on your favorite podcast player.
What can podcasts do, Lauren, that newspaper reports can't? What role are podcasts now filling in reporting the world?
Well, I would say that it allows a certain type of intimacy. I would say specifically for the show that we made with Mickey Whithoff, it allows you to get deeper into the subject. It allows you to hear her perspective. And this was somebody who never talked to mainstream media. She was open to talking to me because I'm not affiliated with any, you know, Hannah works for The Atlantic. I work for myself. And we could spend time. I wasn't on a deadline. I didn't have inches to fill in a newspaper. So I think it allows a deeper type of connection, both for the reporter and for the audience.
Could I lob an idea?
Yes.
It's storytelling. It's the power of storytelling.
Yes.
Well, it's the human voice also, right?
It's the power of a certain kind of storytelling. I think if you make a good podcast and a person listening relaxes into it, you kind of enter the other person's consciousness. So you're sort of, it's so hard right now to see the world from other people's perspective. We're just extremely resistant to that for very good reason. You just, you know, we don't want to enter that perspective. So I think a podcast just allows you to do that because you're primed to relax into the human voice and listen to it. So that's one storytelling element. Another thing is we need all the tools we can to convince people that something is true. Like it's much harder to deny, you know, so people can say, oh, I didn't say that, they misquoted me or they wrote it down wrong. But when you actually have the person's voice saying the thing in a conversation with you that everybody was there for and heard, I think it's harder to deny this didn't happen or the mainstream media is making it up.
Right. Also, you can trust a person. If somebody is investing in listening to a six-part series. You know, I have time to develop a relationship as a host, and I can, you know, I can bring you over into, you know, my style of storytelling, and there's something to that.
I feel like David isn't convinced.
No, I am deeply convinced. I just want to hear your, I want to hear your reasons. Uh-huh. I think the rise of podcasts is a transformative moment in reporting the world to the world. I think it's extraordinarily important. And amongst other things, it puts the lie to this notion that our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. Hannah, that's just not true, is it?
You're putting me on the spot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not true.
She didn't actually hear the question. She was thinking about something else.
My phone.
She was TikToking and also YouTubing.
Lauren, she was not doing any of those things. She was paying attention. Are you going to answer for?
Well, no. Okay, let me say. Let me say one other thing.
I would much prefer you to answer this question.
Thank you. One other thing about podcasting: you can listen very deeply and do other things, such as take a walk. So that is another advantage of podcasting. If you are feeling restless and you can't sit still, no, seriously, that's a wonderful thing about podcasting. I think. I am very heartened that there is still a world of people who want to read long magazine stories and who want to listen to long podcasts. It doesn't really so much bother me that it's not every single person, or it's not that some people don't have the attention span for it. That's okay with me. I am happy to belong to a world in which a certain number of people still love it, have the patience for it, and recognize how important it is. And if anybody listening has ever created that time in their life to sit down and listen to a long podcast or read a novel or whatever it is you do, I do not need to convince you that it has an effect on you, very unlike scrolling. I mean, that's just obvious.
Right. But also, there are plenty of podcasts now where individual episodes run 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And those people, like Joe Rogan, make hundreds of millions of dollars talking for 3 hours at a clip, you know? So I don't think that it's a lack of...
We're not going to do that here.
No. But I bet you could.
Let's go to a bigger question. And that is, what is happening to women in America under Trump? I know it's an enormous question, but... One little sidelight on this. Apparently, the people who were most helped by the DEI policies that he is collapsing were women. And yet, all those policies are being collapsed. His grudges that he says, you know, that he can correct, on the whole, they're not going to help women. But yet, women vote for him. In large numbers, I mean, roughly 50% of the women voted for Trump in the last election. What is this relationship between women and Trump, and what's happening to women in Trump's America? Hannah.
There isn't one relationship with women and Trump. There's many aspects to this relationship. So for some people, the idea that someone who was really recently found liable of sexual assault was elected president was already extremely discouraging. I mean, if you remember, after the last Trump election, there were the pink pussy hat marches in which thousands and thousands of women showed up in Washington, D.C. In the second Trump election, nothing like that happened. I think there was just a general air of discouragement around it.
Sort of become normalized.
It sort of became normal. Not only that, it seemed almost like an asset, like you earned extra man points for being a certain way. And one of the very, very first things he did was pass one of his executive orders saying, you know, the truth of the biological sexes. Men are men and women are women. That's already a shot fired. And so we're just in this flourishing of neo-traditionalism that you can never tell if it's real or not. Like, is our defense secretary serious when he says women shouldn't vote? Like, are trad wives online serious? It's just very hard to tell how really real any of this is. Underneath that is what you mentioned. There are actually DEI policies or things that have regulated the workplace or kind of tamped certain behavior in the workplace that we'd known was around in the 70s and 90s. So there are real effects that trickle down. Now, why women vote for Trump? That was very well examined during the election. People interviewed tons of women. It was for different reasons than this, you know, because he's going to fix the economy. very basic reasons. I can't afford this or that. I mean, inequality in
the
US.
He's going to keep us safe.
He's going to keep us safe.
Things aren't safe in America. I mean, yeah, it's weird because I think there are a lot of people who have held their nose, particularly women, held their nose and voted or said, you know, I just don't care. I don't care. The media makes everything up. He didn't do these terrible things that he's being accused of. It's just one more, you know, it's just fake news. It's fake news. So people believe what they want. And we'll see how it all shakes out. I think for women and, you know, everybody else who voted for him, maybe against their own self-interest.
And it is very hard these days to tell the difference between a joke and not a joke. Like, did
Absolutely.
They eat the pets? Are they telling women not to vote? So you sort of, like, you slough that off. You don't really take it seriously. And you think, what I'm going to vote for is my milk going to be cheaper?
That's, I mean, the joke is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Do you remember that AI-created clip which had a golden statue of Trump standing on the coast of Gaza?
Yeah. And that was one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Sure, but it was retweeted by the White House.
Yeah.
And so is it a joke? Is it serious?
Exactly.
How much can a joke cover? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And does it matter?
And they are very good at it, right? They are very good at it. Lobbing ideas up that they can walk away from and say it was just a joke.
But the effect it has on all of us, I'm sure you too, because you're still talking about that was months ago and it was truly horrific, is it sort of keeps you off balance. Like, we still don't know. We still don't trust that there's a sort of core guiding the policy towards Gaza or anything else. You think, oh, well, they could. They could build casinos in Gaza. It could very well be serious. Oh, no, it's not serious. They would never do anything like that. But they could. So it keeps you on a constant instability.
Well, your head's on a swivel.
Yeah.
At all times, you don't know what to look at. You don't know what to focus on. It's, you know, you're drinking from the fire hose. And then while that's happening, you know, our medical support, our Medicaid program, which is for, you know, low income people, has been completely slashed. And so that is a real impact that they will actually harm real people who actually voted for him. So it's really hard. But when all of this stuff is up here, you know, all of the bad things are happening, or all of the jokes, the gags, the memes, everything is a meme, you know, they can do all the nefarious things.
Okay, so with extraordinary skill, I have brought both of you to the whole point of our interview.
Excellent.
Yes, I mean, we've just got a standing ovation.
Well, you are this. A man. And
I am a man. And a
highly talented
I've
man.
Guided you, thank you. But how do you report this? Hannah, you were about to give an address on this subject. How do you report the Trump operation? What does the media have to do? And a side question, do you think the media in America is now scared?
I actually think, I say this with total earnestness, that there has never been a time when I feel the urgency of my job more than I do right now. You know, I have many times in my career thought journalism and storytelling was interesting, was important. Now I think it's deadly critical because it is so just keeping the record of things as they are happening at the time that they are happening in the very few institutions that still have the resources to do that, of which there are very, very few left compared to there were when I started being a journalist, is like just God's work. Just keep doing it. Keep the scribe. Just keep writing down what's happening because we're shrinking. And if we don't do it, it just won't get done. There will be no record of whether they ate the pets and no record of whether the children were, you know, peeing in the litter boxes. Like, no one will know. So our job is like real basic right now is my feeling about it.
Just basic truth telling.
Really basic. It's like a kindergarten version of journalism, like report on the administration, keep reporting on the administration, keep saying what they're actually doing and do that every single day. And that will be a great public service.
Lauren?
Well, I think also, like Hannah said, we have vanishingly fewer and fewer media outlets that have the bandwidth to do this. And I think that some people are scared. I mean, it is a look, we are entering a world that we have not been in before, where universities, law firms, media entities are paying enormous sums of money to this administration for perceived wrongs. And
they're being shaken down.
They're being shaken down. They are being held upside down by the classroom bully, and all their coins are falling out. And so it is a scary time, but I think what Hannah said is right, that sort of focusing on what is actually happening and what's happening behind what they're saying. I think there's been a lot of really great reporting. There was a great story recently about how much money Trump has actually made in the short time that he has been in office in his second term, and it is breathtaking. And the amount of money that his family has made will last them for generations. And it's only out of what deals he has made and his family have made. And that's important. That's important.
That sounds to me like absolutely traditional role of the media.
100%.
Nothing new, nothing fancy, just do what you're taught to do and keep doing it.
Yes, but 20 years ago, I wouldn't have said that to you with great earnestness, like as if you didn't know it or understand it, like I was doing a journalism school, you know, 101 first day of class with you. I wouldn't have said that. I would have made up something fancier or something about narratives or storytelling. Now it's like...
We did a bit of narrative and storytelling earlier. But.
Yes.
It's just the basic chores of journalism.
Yes, because the lies are outrageous and they're happening 50 times a day. So
but the problem is there aren't the places to publish what you're doing.
Not like there were.
No. And also, I mean, now we have a White House briefing room that has a number of quote unquote media outlets that are nothing but MAGA house organs that are not journalists. People call themselves investigative journalists. When we were doing this podcast with the MAGA folks, I ran into them all the time. I'm an investigative journalist, because they would go to events and write what they saw on Twitter. And so it's really hard, I think, to step up and claim, you know, I'm a journalist, when it's sort of like been diluted.
Although I will say it's a struggle right now. Like the Trump administration has more or less stayed within the lines. Like they play a game, the media pushes back. So they kick out the Associated Press, which is our general news service, because they refuse to print the Gulf of America instead
of the
Gulf
of Mexico.
Are they still out? No. So they come back in. You know, so it's a kind of game that's being played, and we're still kind of in the zone. Like there are still journalists who have access to the pool, but then there are all these other people, as Lauren said, who call themselves journalists, or, you know, like Trump during the campaign, who only went on Manosphere podcasts and did most of his interviews there instead of the traditional media. So it's a real mix right now.
Can we stand back for a moment from the question of truth?
Yes.
To admire the astonishing performance of that woman who is the press spokesman for Trump. I mean, what's her name?
Carolyn Leavitt.
She's spectacularly great.
Yes, and she's very young, David. She's very young.
Yeah, but what a performer.
Yeah, yeah.
She's got a big career ahead of her. She could run the Navy one day.
Don't you feel like those who will rule the earth are the performers? Like, if you could just wake up and think, like, what I need to be is a performer. Like, it began with Ronald Reagan.
You don't have to tell me that. Nah, you don't have to tell me that.
Or the apex performer,
yes,
right?
Sure, exactly.
Clear to me, it's clear to you. Yeah, if you can't perform. I mean, one of the problems with Biden is he ceased to be able to perform.
Mm-hmm. But does that mean to entertain?
No.
But there is something about it. It's like, yes, you perform, but also what Carolyn Leavitt is doing is it is not just performing, but it is a full performance that entertains the MAGA crowd. They love to see her. They love to see anyone from that administration cut the liberal media down to
five. You know
what,
though? Journalists love her, despite themselves.
That's the thing.
Yes. But that's the gloss of her performance.
But it's not just the journalists love her. News broadcasts love her.
Yes.
So that her lies are actually broadcast.
Yes.
Around the world.
And they go down easy, David.
Because they're such...
Why?
But exactly,
why?
Lauren,
because Kellyanne Conway, who
not as lovable. Doesn't work the same way.
What?
I don't know why. It just doesn't.
What is Caroline Leavitt's lovability?
Now, look, there are some issues.
Define such a
there thing? Are some issues that even late night live can't grapple with. And Lauren, you've raised.
Thank you for pulling us back from
one.
The break.
The essence of charisma is one of those, Lauren.
Yes.
I wouldn't know anything
the
about
the undefinable X factor.
What happens in the United States of America when the magician, the man who said, I can solve this, I can solve that, I can fix this, I can fix that, when the magician is proved to have no powers? Lauren, what happens in America?
I want to say nothing. If we're talking specifically about Trump, look, this has been his stock and trade for his entire life. It's smoke and mirrors, and it always has been, from the time that he was a real estate developer, a casino magnate. What happens? I mean, I don't think that we're going to see people out in the streets saying, you lied to me. Like, I thought you were going to fix, you know, the economy. And I still don't, you know, that they're always going to find some type of a scapegoat. And the system, I think, currently is set up to allow for that. I mean, they didn't call him Teflon Don for nothing.
This is not a one-man show, David. I wish it were. For one
not
thing,
anymore.
He's created a political style behind which are dozens and dozens and dozens of imitators. And there, a lot of them are politicians. A lot of them are cultural figures. So there's many more potentially waiting in the wings. And second is that he's created and he's allowed so many actual structural changes, both to the power of the executive branch. Those are not reversible. To Supreme Court decisions. Those are not reversible. And to gerrymandering, which is, you know, who votes for who and how
coming
voting
up
is decided. So,
yep. Let me go back to a question I asked before. Is the media now scared of him?
I don't think so. I think that there's, well,
I don't think scared is correct, but I think that there's such an unpredictability with this man and this administration. I think there are so many things that have happened even just in the last 6 months that we could not have ever predicted. The American universities capitulating to
law firms caving in,
right? And I don't think that we thought that was part of the game plan. I think it's just that anytime we try to predict, you know, he changes the goalposts.
I actually think the media has held its ground pretty well. I think the individual cases in which you would describe the media as caving in or capitulating has to do with the media's ownership. So that they were in the middle of some deal or another and they didn't want to risk his ire so that their kind of corporate decision making wasn't interrupted. That's different than the media capitulating, which I don't think the media is capitulating. Like, I don't think there is a handful of media organizations with enough power still to write what they want to write.
But they sacked Colbert.
They did. But Colbert isn't capitulating. That was a corporate decision.
Well, he's not capitulating until they take him off air sometime next year.
So he can just start another show and it'll get millions and millions of views on YouTube. Like, there are plenty of outlets. Like, maybe corporate media companies are capitulating. Does that count as the media capitulating?
I think it does, doesn't
okay.
it? Doesn't it? Are you looking forward
Rupert
to
Murdoch didn't
are you looking forward to Rupert the case against Rupert Murdoch?
Yes, because he didn't capitulate. So that's an interesting scrambled one as a person who, you know, just decided he doesn't have to capitulate. So we'll
right.
see how that one goes. It's interesting.
I think there's so many liberals in America who cannot believe how much they like the Wall Street Journal now.
Exactly. He's my hero, Rupert Murdoch,
right?
Now.
And do you think that might not have been in Mr. Murdoch's calculations? Exactly that sense that it will endear that newspaper to a new world of readers. He is a commercial man.
Interesting.
Let me let you into that secret. Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah. He's got a commercial flair. While they're laughing, I'm going to say that I have been speaking to Hannah Rosen, host of the podcast Radio Atlantic, and her partner, Lauren Ober, who has with her made this new podcast called We Live Here Now.
We live here now.
We've made our home in Sydney.
Well, you've been fed twice since we started speaking and they brought you in slippers. thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. This has been a really good time.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
That's it for the show. Next on Late Night Live Summer, the writer Robert McFarlane talks about rivers, not just as moving water, but living beings and how they should be treated as such. He's winning over governments. Plus the tale of a very wealthy American who triggered a craze for Mars and Martians at the turn of the 20th century. It's a fascination that's never died.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.